This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. This show is brought to you by Drafts. Drafts is where tech starts on your iPhone or iPad. Drafts is an app designed to capture notes, ideas, status updates, then let you share them with a practically limitless array of options. We'll tell you more about that as the show goes on. Come in, Bradley. How are you?
Fantastic. It's a beautiful day here in Chattanooga, 66 degrees and sunny.
You know, I let my wife listen to one of the introductions that I do to the podcast, and she said, as soon as you came on, she just said, Bradley just sounds so much cheerier than you do.
Well, that's what happens when you're living in the gig city, as we like to say, with this fast internet.
Oh, yeah. It's like a little bit of South Korea in North America.
Yeah, but with grits and sweet tea. and non-dessert food that has marshmallows. They call it sweet potato casserole. No, so, yeah, found out this week, or like 2 weeks ago, that I never tested it, but we had been upgraded at work to 400 by 400 as our speed. But, you know, they had like done a speed increase. So, of course, I live on Wi-Fi all day, and so you're never going to get anywhere near that on Wi-Fi. It's just not, 802.11 AC, you can get, obviously getting up there and you can cluster with that. But I don't, my Mac doesn't have 802.11 AC. So I went into, found one of our iMacs that was wired into Ethernet and then went to speedtest.net. And one, our ISP actually hosts a speedtest.net server. And I got to 450 megs up and down.
And then you trolled me with a screenshot.
Over a couple of days, actually. But, of course, the interesting thing is just, of course, I know this, but I went and did some testing and did the USB to Ethernet, and it tops out at 100. And I, even though my Mac has USB 3, I'm pretty sure that adapter is like maybe a USB 2 adapter.
Yeah.
And so it tops out at 100 by 100. But in all seriousness, as cool as that seems and sounds, in general day-to-day stuff, I don't think you could tell. Honestly, don't even know, like, once you get above 50, if you can really tell, like, just day-to-day surfing the web. You know, again, obviously, if we had, multiple campuses that we could kind of link together with all that same connection, that's one thing. But, you know, how fast can Google Apps and Evernote get online? How fast can those things sync?
Well, that's the truth of the matter, isn't it? That sometimes the origin server can't provide you at the speed that you could actually download it at in theory. I guess it's more an issue of capacity. So if you want to stream a whole bunch of stuff over different channels, then you could do that kind of thing.
Yeah, and then you get to like the limits of like how fast can your computer even render things, like when you're loading, how fast can Safari even render a web page? And again, not that I'm not excited to have it, because you certainly have to build that infrastructure before the applications can come along.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, in some ways, it's just bragging points. And that's why I've not upgraded to gigabit at home. I could do it for $12 a month, but I just don't think you could tell. I mean, the most demanding thing we do at home is stream Netflix. And I mean, what's a super HD Netflix movie? It's got to be like 10 megs or less, demand wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I think 4K is going to be the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that'll be the kicker. But again, the infrastructure has to be there nationwide and worldwide before that'll really take off. Of course, I think I may have mentioned this on my past show, that my ISP, I know some people there, they actually have a Netflix caching server there, and they have one from YouTube as well. And that saves everybody bandwidth. It saves Netflix from having to send it to the ISP, and it saves the ISP from how they're basically serving it out locally. And so that's kind of neat to think that, like, when you're streaming Netflix, you're getting it from inside your city.
Yeah, and you're presumably in the fortunate position where you don't have to get it through a cable company, right?
I do not.
Yeah, it's throttled like everybody else is getting it.
Yeah, it's a local power company. And that's one of the cool things. You know, I think I heard it on the last episode of the Accidental Tech podcast. It's at atp.fm, and they were talking, I think John Syracuse was talking about kind of how it's sad that the companies that provide you with the services, the same company that like owns the pipes. And it would almost be good if you had companies that just provided the pipes, and you had other companies that provided the service on each end. And so everybody just kind of focused on one thing, where Comcast is very much concerned about people canceling their TV and signing up for internet because they apparently can't make it just on internet, obviously without raising the rates. So you have all these things where Netflix is being throttled, and a lot of that makes me sad.
Yeah, I'm surprised that enough people are even thinking about doing that to make that something you would want to throttle. You know, I think the number of people on Comcast or whoever who are thinking about, you know, cutting the cable and just going Netflix only. I mean, how many people realistically is that? Is that just a paranoia move? Could be.
I don't know. I think the kicker, especially here in the States, is ESPN content. You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know what availability of sports content like you know you have, because I know like you can pay the NFL directly to watch football or American football, but I cannot. Like I have to buy it through DirecTV and have their satellite package, and so I think that's the kicker for a lot of people is there's no way without having someone's, you know, Comcast login or Verizon login that you can watch ESPN like on an Apple TV. But I guess as I've gotten older and the thought about having to spend what we spend on cable, it just kind of made me sick over time when I realized how little we watched it. And you know, the majority of the things that we watch, we can watch off an antenna. And that's why I went to that, because we, you know, NBC, ABC, Fox, and the CW is about 95% of the stuff we watch, and it's free. So, yeah. But I do think you're probably right that your average person, in some ways, it's just easier to still have cable. I mean, I think we obviously live in our world where people are coming up with, you know, hacky solutions to get TV for, you know, inexpensively. But, you know, my father-in-law, for example, he doesn't want to fool with the time on trying to make something like that work. It's just easier for him to pay the $70 a month for his cable package.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I mean, it's similar in the UK here. If you want to watch like live Premiership football from England, you have to have a Sky subscription, but you can watch like the highlights package on BBC for free. I mean, I've never had a TV, we have BBC iPlayer, obviously, is both live and on demand. So you can watch whatever's on television right now through your iPad live for free if you're in the UK. And then you can watch the highlights package. But the BBC doesn't have the rights to every live sport. For example, the example I gave there was Premiership football. That's the one that Sky have paid bazillions of dollars or pounds, probably, to have the live rights for. So the BBC can only show a highlights package. And sometimes that's also true for things like the Rugby World Cup, for example, where that was on ITV, which is a free-to-air channel in the UK, but they don't have a very good streaming service. And the European football is the same. So there's a wee bit of that, but not quite so much. We can kind of get by without paying a lot of money for cable.
Well, I think, you know, that's kind of our thought. It's certainly in some ways more inconvenient because you have to, you miss some things. But when you start thinking about what you spend per year, over, you know, we've not had cable in probably 2 years at this point, and you think we've probably saved close to $2,000, and that's a lot of money. Figure if you did that for 10 years, I mean, so, but you're starting to see some of that, you know, I'm hoping we're seeing some of that break apart. Not a big fan of professional wrestling, I guess, as they would say it. I was when I was a kid, but the fact that the WWE network is going to be $10 a month on basically every device, and it has live pay-per-views, all their back catalog, like those kind of models are nice when you can just choose to buy what you want to buy. So hopefully more of that will come, as if, you know, some companies do it and consumers pay up, then we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how much of that stuff people actually want. You know, if it goes a la carte like that, how much of the stuff that does get made and broadcast will people actually go out and seek and pay for themselves?
As my friend Aaron Mankey says, it's, you know, us nerds like to talk a lot about paying for stuff, but when it comes to it, do we actually pay for it?
We're very good at working ways around not doing that.
True. So before we move on, let's thank our sponsor for this week. It's Drafts from the fine folks at Agile Tortoise. They sponsored last week with Phraseology, and Drafts is our sponsor this week. And I'll tell you, Drafts is one of those apps on your iOS devices that it seems very simple, but it can do so many things if you kind of put the time into getting it started. It's really where tech starts for iPhone or iPad. It's an app designed to capture notes, ideas, status updates, and then you can basically share them with anywhere you want to. So it opens up with a blank draft ready to type, no extra fiddling to create a new note, no navigating through an inbox or timeline to get a composed view. You just launch and type. So once you capture something, Drafts is ready to act. Use one of its many output options. You can send it as an email, a text message. You can create a calendar event, a reminder. You can post the status to Twitter or Facebook. Even at the same time, actually, you can, you know, you could actually have one update go to Twitter, Facebook, and app.net if you wanted to. You could even save or append a note to Evernote or Dropbox. Then you could even forward the text to a growing list of other apps like OmniFocus Things, Fantasticale, Tweetbot. Again, the options there are limitless. So one of the things that I do is I use Wunderlist, and I've used it for probably close to 10 months now. Well, they are working on version 3, and I'm hoping it has just kind of support for some of the things that Drafts does. But it does have support for the ability to email stuff into your inbox. So I created an action that basically I can launch Drafts, type something, click save to send to Wunderlist, click send on the email, and it gets good to go. So Drafts will automatically pre-fill the email to where it gets into my Wunderlist inbox. So again, it's very, very easy to use. Drafts for the iPhone is $2.99, and Drafts for the iPad with Lightning Fast Sync, that's free, is only $3.99 on the App Store. You can visit the web to find out more. We'll have a link to the show notes. It's at agiletortoise.com/drafts. We'll have a special link in the show notes that will let the folks at Agile Tortoise know that you came from our show. So we'd appreciate you going through that link. But again, this is one of those apps that, again, seems simple, and it is simple, but it can really open up a lot of powerful tools for you on iOS. So, again, thanks for Drafts. Thanks to Drafts for sponsoring the show this week.
I literally just had an idea for what to do with that app as you were talking there, Bradley.
What's that?
I've been fiddling about with Evernote as a to-do list application. I've kind of gone back and forth on this for ages, but one of my kind of complaints about Evernote, and it's kind of a funny complaint, is that it's so good at taking you back to the last thing you looked at, that to go and make a new note, you've kind of got to back out of the note you're in, go back a few levels up, and get to the bit where you can start a new note again. And as a result, it kind of was always kind of fiddly to put a new note into a to-do list notebook, for example. And just an idea there that you could hook up Drafts and just fire open Drafts, type what you want, and then one button, send it into the specific notebook that you want to send it to.
Yeah.
I should get on that.
Yeah, Drafts, in a lot of ways, is powering a lot of the iOS automation that you're seeing on sites like MacStories.net, because it's so, it's kind of like the hub for everything. I mean, if you start it in Drafts, and there are so many places you can go from there, you can, one of the things I do is if I have an idea for a blog article, I'll start it in Drafts and then send it into Byword. Again, obviously, Drafts supports Markdown and things like that, but it's great for, if your wife says, hey, this is what I want when you're picking up dinner, you open up the app, you start typing, it saves automatically. They use the Sync from the Simperium, which that was the company that built the app Simple Note, and that's now owned by Automattic. But yeah, they use the Simperium Sync, and it's free and it's lightning fast.
I like things that are both free and fast.
Yeah, fast and free. Sounds like a good movie.
Okay. So I guess this is it. This is episode 2 of our Deployment 2014 series. Got some really great feedback on the first episode. A lot of people really appreciated that. And we're very grateful for all that feedback. It's been very useful to give us an idea of what we want to do next and where we want to go with some of this stuff. Tonight, as a kind of second setup part, if you like, I wanted to talk, Bradley, about the whole idea of your school in a broader context. And by broader context, I could mean, and I do mean all of these things, either in the context of the future, what's going to happen in the future, how's the world going to be in 2020, 2030, whenever your kids are going to leave school, the school in the context of the country or the region that you work in, and then the school more specifically in terms of things like the local context, the political context that you work in, and then get down to brass tacks and talk about, who do you have working in the school? What's the staff context? What's the parent context? What are the key things that you have to think about down from that, sort of 50,000 foot view of the future and, the changes in the economy and all that kind of stuff, all the way down to, well, what do the people in your school today think about this plan? So we're going to try and attempt all of that in one show. Do you think we can make it?
I hope so.
Okay. let's begin with the future and work our way backwards to now. I suppose, well, one of the things, and whenever I present to schools or to groups of people or whatever, I always start with this topic because it's the one that kind of makes people sit up and think a little bit. And it's about basically where we're going as a developed society, if you like. And I think the key insight to start with all of this is that education takes a long time to get anything done. I don't mean that just in the sense that it takes our schools and our institutions time to change, although that is true. But changes that you make today are only seen in the general population in 20 to 25 to 30 years' time. You know, so if I start teaching kids to use tablets as 5-year-olds now, they're not going to be in the workforce for another 14 years, 15 years maybe. So in that sense, I think education has to be outleading rather than sort of trailing behind the way society is going. So if you're in a reactive mode, and let's face it, probably in your country, Bradley, and in my country as well, and certainly in probably most of the Western countries where education is an organized, nationalized system, those institutions are highly reactive to situations and sometimes reactive a long time afterwards. So something changes, something new comes out, and it's 5, 10, 15, 20 sometimes years before those changes are adopted into the education system. That's point number one.
Well, and you're also in a situation, let's look back in the, at the U.S. and the policies that George W. Bush put into place with No Child Left Behind. I mean, that mm-hmm. drastically affected what the public education system did for many years. But then you have situations where you have new leadership come in. So you have mm-hmm. one president, one Congress, and then they make changes. Well, then 4 or 8 years later, things change again. And so just by the time schools are getting around to adopting one philosophy or one way of life, new administration comes in at the government level and changes it again. And so you're just having to basically start over.
Yeah, and this is a massive cost in terms of goodwill, both among students and teachers and staff and parents and everybody. But I guess, you know, that is the way it is, right? And there's not a whole lot we can do about that. But I think it does mean that we have to be aware as teachers and as school administrators and planners that we have to kind of get a move on, if you like. And that's something that's always kind of fundamental in my thinking. And the way I've described this when I present to people is I say, look, a child starting school in 2014, at least in the Scottish system, will not be entering university until the year 2027. And our degrees are usually 4 years, at least they are at the moment. There's debate about whether that might change. But, you know, they would be a graduate potentially in the year 2031. Now, if you want to tell me today that I should be making decisions about computers in my school based on what businesses are using in 2013, 2014, for a pupil who will probably not walk out into a job until 2031, is it really a credible argument to say that I should be using Windows today to teach these children? Because when they get a job, people will still be using Windows. That doesn't seem as likely as perhaps it once did.
Well, and with that rationale, I mean, you think about the software packages, how everybody uses Outlook and Office at their business environments. And, you know, think back to the things that we used in school. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't matter anymore. It's a different world. Heck, we didn't even have broadband in my home until I was a junior in high school. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, you're exactly right that the argument that because of what you use at your job today matters to a third grader. It just doesn't add up.
Yeah. So the first thing I want to try and do is instill into the listeners and also just to people I speak to, you've got to be thinking way beyond what you can see today or what you have personal experience of or what you're personally comfortable with. And in some ways, if you are comfortable with what you're teaching and using in school, then you're already too late. That's something to be concerned about. I always use this phrase or this quote, the estimate that has been around for a while now, that by the year 2025, there'll be something like 50 billion devices connected to the internet. Now, I've used that quote for a couple of years now, and I think at some level it's actually a little bit out of date now, because some of the estimates are putting that at 2020, that there'll be that kind of access to devices. Now, obviously, that's not going to be, that's not 50 billion smartphones, that's 50 billion devices connected to the internet. And as, you know, the Internet of Things comes along and cars get connected and stuff like that, then obviously those all count towards that total as well. But the point is that that's going to be, if you look at the UN population projections for the future, that's going to be about 6.4 devices for every person alive on the planet. Now, there will be some people on the planet, certainly by then, who maybe don't have any devices. But then there'll be people in the West who will have like more devices than they can even begin to handle. So it's not going to be evenly distributed, to steal the William Gibson quote. But, you know, we're sort of still debating and talking about whether or not we should be one-to-one in schools. And the world's racing away from one-to-one. The world did one-to-one 20 years ago. Right, everybody had their own computer 20 years ago, who worked, who had a job, who was a professional. And the way that the world is going is it's going to be a world of tons of devices per person. You know, it'll be 6.4, then it'll be 10, then it'll be 15. And how do you even begin to prepare somebody for that kind of world? I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but you have to be aware that that is the world that is to come.
You know, I was having a conversation with a teacher yesterday, and she asked me, did you go to school for what you do? And I said, no. I said, I went to school for business. I said, but the funny thing is, you know, again, I'm 29, so I've not been out of college that long. The things that I do didn't exist when I was in college. And so you think about how that'll be 20 years from now. What will I be doing 20 years from now? You know, not even thinking about my elementary or middle or high school curriculum. The stuff I did in college is way out of date from a technology perspective.
Yeah. And this is why it's such a catastrophic error to write a curriculum specifically around something like Microsoft Office, for example. You know, the idea that you close the window by clicking on the X versus teaching the idea that there are windows and that you can close them is a fundamentally correct versus incorrect way to think about teaching things around technology. The other way that you can do it is you can just only teach the things that won't change. And that's the approach that some people have taken with technology education, is to strip out anything that might change. Knowing that we can't revise curricula fast enough, let's only teach the core fundamentals that probably won't change. And that typically means, you know, sort of C-like programming, because that's the thing that's sort of endured for 40 years or more. And everything else has moved around about it. But that's the future, right? And I think there's no great way to predict the future. I mean, if there was, wouldn't we all be a lot richer than we are? But there are certainly some techniques you can use. And it's beyond the scope of this show to go into a full list of the sort of futurology techniques that are used. But I want to recommend one book that I've used, and I think it's very, very useful. It's called Futuring. It's by a guy called Edward Cornish, and the subtitle is The Exploration of the Future. And it's not crystal ball or New Age or astrology or anything like that. It describes a set of techniques that are used by forecasters in business and forecasters in government and government agencies to try and assess where we are and what might come in the future. We'll put a link to the show notes in the show notes to that book, and I think it's a very, very good beginner's guide to using some of these techniques. And I think what's critical is that there should be at least one person in your school or organization who is at least faintly familiar with these techniques and knows how to use some of them and is aware of, you know, what is a mega trend, for example, and what does it mean to be using a technique like horizon scanning or sampling or something like that. And I think that's a very, very important skill to have somewhere. And it's not something that every teacher needs to know, but if you're part of planning and you're part of looking into where the future's going, then I think these are techniques that somebody has to be familiar with.
You know, I think for me, you think back and look at like me and my wife and how our computing has evolved over the past 10 years, 15 years. I think you could maybe simplify it down to teach kids how to learn new things in the future. Because the entire world changes, not just technology, everything changes. You know, how you talk to people, how you interact, you know, how you go to the grocery store and do things. You know, it goes back to problem-solving skills and learning to adapt. Because think about the world that our parents grew up in. Drastically different than we live today. But they evolved and adapted. And, you know, you look at, they talk about this like with athletes a lot. You know, how do you evolve as your career gets older? How does your game change, whether it be football, baseball, basketball? And they evolve and they change their skill set. And that largely is what kids need to learn how to do, because the world around them changes. You know, to think back to when I was in middle school and what life was like is nothing like it is today. I remember when we were trying to get our parents to come pick us up from school, we would call using collect, and then we would just say, "Hey, come pick me up, bye," and hang up. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the world we were living in. But you evolved.
You would ring the phone twice and then hang up, so you didn't have to pay. That kind of
thing. Exactly. Yeah. And that you, but we evolved and we adapted. And you're right to have that argument about Microsoft Word or Windows seems so trivial in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah. Yeah, you're essentially just building skills for the very short term rather than building capabilities for the long term. Yeah, futuring is hard because it has a bad reputation because it's easy to get it wrong. But I think that at some level, you know, a lot of people I talk to are very kind of like, oh, the world changes so fast, there's nothing we can do about it, we can't cope, there's no way we can cope. And I think that's a lot of rubbish because although the sort of surface presentation of stuff changes a lot, the fundamentals don't change that often. But the problem is that too often we teach the surface presentation of these things. We don't teach the fundamental techniques or the fundamental theories or the fundamental understanding of what these things are and doing that kind of analysis. And I think that's kind of a frustration to me, because I feel like in some ways the world doesn't change fast enough. You know, where's my self-driving car? You know, where's my 50-pound 3D printer? Right? These things are coming, but they're not coming overnight. It's not like one day you wake up and suddenly you can buy a 3D printer for 50 quid. Like, by the time that's true, 3D printers will have been known about and understood for about 8 to 10 years beforehand. And if you don't know what's coming out next, then you just haven't really been paying attention, is the fundamental point I want to make.
Yeah, you know, going back to the Microsoft Word example, we shouldn't be teaching kids, you know, where the bold button is on the toolbar. It's teaching them why you should bold things.
Mm-hmm. Because it will always be different, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, talking to a school here recently and talking about their movie making class where they teach kids how to make movies, that they didn't want to upgrade to the new version of iMovie. Mm. And his point was, so you're teaching iMovie rather than movie making skills. Yeah. And those are two drastically different things.
Yeah.
And if you're...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, if you took a movie making class that used iMovie HD, I mean, you're two major releases behind then.
Yeah. Yep. And it is always thus, but we were having this conversation recently about, you know, we kind of had to sit around and have these conversations in the staff room about what would it be like if we got to teach this or that. And, you know, we were talking about what would true 21st century skills be. And one of the ones we came up with was just a class about coping with change. Not specifically about changing software or the changing the presentation of technologies, but just coping with change of all kinds. Changes in social attitudes, changes climate change, technological change, you know, organizational change, restructuring, changes in the curriculum. What are above all of these kind of like little ripples on the surface, what are the fundamental skills that go below any particular change, and how do you cope with all kinds of change at one time or multiple kinds of change at one time? I think that would be a very interesting class to write a program for at some point.
I mean, it just changed so quickly, though. Your curriculum would change. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Change, you need a class about changing your... Yeah, yeah, just a spiral effect.
Yeah, then it's just inception all the way down. Right. So let me leave the future there for now, Bradley, but I think it's when you talk about, you know, technology programs and things like that, I think you do have to be looking very far ahead. It's like when you're driving fast, you've got to look further ahead down the road. If you're driving slowly, you can just look towards the end of your car. But when you're driving fast, you've got to look a lot further ahead. And I think it's just something that people have to be aware of, is that you have to be, or somebody has to be on top of what's going on. That's enough about the future, I think. Next thing I want to talk about is the current sort of national context, if you like. And I was had a bizarrely enjoyable time recently just looking through some reports that I had about the UK as a whole. And I don't know if there are similar things in the US, Bradley. I'm sure there are. But in the UK, there's the Communications Market Regulator, who set kind of regulatory stuff for like telephones and internet and so on. In the UK, they're called Ofcom, the Office of the Communications Regulator. And I suppose the FCC might be the equivalent in the US.
FCC funded by lobbyists.
Yeah. So one of the things that Ofcom does is quite interesting, because what they do is they produce a thing called the Communications Market Report. And they do it every year. And they ask similar questions every year, but every so often they bring in new ones to reflect new things that have happened. But it's like a 400-page document, and there's lots of bits that are not that interesting to me personally, but they have this whole section about the use of the internet. And they ask some really interesting questions. Now, before we talk about this, I want to ask, are you familiar, do people in the US know about like social grades in terms of like A, B, C, 1, C, 2, D, and E? Are you aware of it?
I'm not aware of it.
Okay. Well, let me just, this is a thing, I think it may be a UK thing, but it's kind of useful anyway. And what it is it sort of, it tries to break down the idea of like being middle class or working class into a little more nuance, right? So they have these six bands within the middle and working classes where they basically break out people into certain income groups, almost by profession. So it's been around for a while. It's called the NRS Social Grade. And you talk about people being in A, B, or C1, or C2, or D, or E. And what an A person is, if somebody's in the A group, they're some kind of high-end manager, admin professional or something like that. So like a doctor, for example, would be an A, somebody who earns quite a lot of money and has a professional job. B is a sort of middle class, middle manager, you know, A professional, like maybe a teacher, something like that. C1 is what they call lower middle class, which is some kind of supervisory role, but not necessarily senior in that sense. And then C2 is what you call skilled working class, so skilled manual worker, you know, welder, car mechanic, something like that. And then D is semi and unskilled manual worker, so somebody working in an Amazon packing factory, for example, might be considered in that category. And then E is the non-working group, so it's pensioners, students, casual workers, or, you know, day laborers and things like that. So there's these six groups. And they're typically split into A, B, C1 is one kind of group, which is sort of like the middle class, if you like, and C2, D, and E is typically the sort of working class. And the reason I go into that detail is because Ofcom, what they do when they produce these reports is they talk about the access that these different socioeconomic groups have to certain kinds of technology. That's very, very interesting, because some of the key points, and this is, I hope you'll see why this becomes relevant in a minute, because obviously any school should know or should have some idea of the kind of income distribution that the families in that school would have. Do you follow me so far, Bradley?
Yeah.
That makes sense? So you're going to have some sense of, you know, is this school mostly comprised of A, B, C1 families? Or do we have, you know, 60% DE families, or do we have 40%? And it's not that you can say that this school, because the school is a big organization regardless, you can't say that this school is all DE or this school is all AB. You're going to have a mix. In most schools, you're going to have a mix. But you need to know or have some idea of what that mix is. And then if you have that kind of rough idea, you can then start to go and look at, well, what can I sort of reasonably expect this school, the home life of these children to look like, okay? So let me just give you some examples, right? The 2013 report put UK home internet access at 80% overall. So 4 out of 5 homes in the UK have internet access. That's a question you're going to want to ask if you are going to plan a one-to-one deployment, right? But if you break it down, AB households, the top two bands, 92% internet access, C1, 85%, C2, 79%. And in those DE bands, 65%. So if you're dealing with a predominantly upper middle class school or catchment area, you can have a very reasonable expectation that almost everybody in your school will have internet at home. Whereas if you're dealing with a very poor area and mostly low-income families, you've got a reasonable chance that it might be getting close to 50-50. That's something to be aware of. Now, of course, if people live in your town, Bradley, they've got, you know, 100 gigabit internet wired into their brains, right?
Oh, yeah.
But again, and that's another question, right? If you live in a rural area that's not well connected, then that number may be even lower for reasons that are not just about their income. Because, you know, if you live in somewhere like, you know, the remote highlands of Scotland, then rich or poor, you probably can't buy reasonable internet access at any price. Something to be aware of as well.
And a lot of those rural areas rely on LTE, which then it's capped.
Mm-hmm.
So since they have to be concerned, it's a it's Sunday infinite resource. They had to find that resource. They have to manage that usage.
Yep. Or in the Highlands of Scotland, I believe a lot of people depend on satellite internet access, for example, which is of course quite expensive, relatively speaking. Usually capped, and also sometimes weather dependent as well, which is unfortunate if you live in Scotland because it's raining in those areas quite a lot of the time. So. That's something I would think people should be aware of, right, is what kind of constituency are you dealing with? What can you reasonably expect them to have access to or be able to get in terms of home broadband or access to computers or something like that? I want to just pull out another stat. I don't want to just turn this into a stat show, but there are some interesting numbers in this whole report. Another one was that they asked people who were not online, they said, well, why don't you want to be online? And one of the natural kind of assumptions that people often make when they talk about doing one-to-one programs and sending devices home and so on, is people kind of make the assumption that people who aren't online at home are not online because they're too poor to afford it, basically. They can't afford it and they don't want to spend the money. And in fact, when Ofcom asked that question, they found that only 12% of people who weren't online said that they were not online because they couldn't afford it. And in fact, 77% of people who gave a reason for not being online said that their main reason for getting online was because they weren't interested. I thought that was quite interesting as well, because the people that are not online might not be online for the reasons you assume. You know, a lot of people make that assumption that it's because of cost, but sometimes it's because of lack of interest or just perhaps just general ignorance about what it could do for you.
Yeah, it was my wife's grandfather is deals with mutual funds quite a bit as he's retired and he's getting into that. And he does it all by mailing things in and placing orders over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to him about the internet and he could just like buy this stuff instantly. He's just not interested. He could afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But he has no interest in being on the internet.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's not someone that our schools are concerned about. But, those people exist that just, want the simpler ways of life.
Yeah. And Ofcom also showed that it was that 75 plus group that were the least keen to take up home internet access. But it certainly wasn't by any means only those people. It was certainly there's younger people as well who, for whatever reason, lack of knowledge, lack of awareness, just don't want to be on the internet. Almost nobody, interestingly, cited security as a concern. That number's gone down over time. A little more to our point, Bradley. Ofcom also tracked tablet usage, and they have done for a couple of years. And there's a few interesting numbers came out of that too. Number one was that tablet ownership in the UK is now at 24%. Almost one in four households in the UK has got a tablet in it. I was blown away by that. I couldn't believe it was as high as that. And that's doubled over the last year.
I'm very interested to see what that does in the next 12 to 24 months as well. Mm-hmm. Does it level out, or does it keep on rising at the rate it does? Because if we're looking at doubled in the past year, if Apple somehow gets an even lower cost iPad out, does that thing triple in that next year? I don't know. That'll be interesting to see. It'll also be interesting to see, how the tablet ownership growth kind of correlates with the PC
general you know, statistics. Does that, does PC ownership start to fall off and maybe people are actually having fewer ones as they have maybe two tablets at home? I don't know, but that'll be interesting to see.
Yes, it will be. And I think there's another stat that came out of Ofcom that sort of feeds into that a little bit, which is that they asked people, the question, the overall question was, which is your most important device for connecting to the internet? And they asked, they sort of split the answers out into for people who've only got a laptop, for people who've got a laptop and a smartphone, for people who've got a laptop, a smartphone, and a tablet. Because obviously, you know, if you don't own a device, then it's not going to be important to you. But what they found was that for those people who own both a tablet and a laptop, 34% of people said that the laptop was most important to them. But 32% of people who own both a laptop and a tablet said the tablet was as important to them, was most important to them. So what that shows me is that the tablet and the laptop, for people who've got both, is almost kind of neck and neck, you know, 2% in it either way. So people who own tablets seem to really love them, is a sort of thread that's come out of that. And I know you and I, Bradley, were having this conversation recently about people who don't really like tablets very much, or people who kind of criticize tablets often do that from a position of not having ever owned or used a tablet. And that was a conversation we had about some other podcast shows that we listened to, where people were sort of saying things about tablets that kind of indicated a little bit that they didn't really use it for very much at all. Whereas people like you and I, who have delved deeply into tablets, and obviously, you know, for a large proportion of people surveyed in by Ofcom, people who heavily invest in tablets in the sense of their time and effort really come to love them and consider them to be very, very important to them.
Yeah, we was having this conversation with someone else recently about how all devices have compromises. You know, obviously there are compromises a tablet makes, you know, whether it be iOS, you know, the Kindle or anything, compromises versus its laptop counterparts. But for me, what it allows me to do is worth that compromise. It opens up so many other avenues. And so it's just about, you know, I think when people view tablets as basically glorified ebook readers or glorified Kindle devices, I think they're missing what it could do, just as if you only looked at your iPhone as a phone.
Absolutely. And if you just looked at your laptop like a thing you can carry from one desk to another. I mean, laptops have become absolutely the dominant form factor for desktop-class computers, but they have their own compromises as well. You know, they're typically, the screens are much smaller than you could get with a desktop computer. They cost, relatively speaking, much more than the equivalent desktop computer for typically less capabilities as well. Yet they've become completely dominant. Why? Because of convenience. Convenience always beats quality, in my opinion.
Oh, we've seen that with media formats for years.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember those days of, you know, the laptop was half as powerful and twice as much. Mm-hmm. But you look at what happened there as well. The desktop, the, you know, the power growth of it, you know, the laptop caught up to it. And so, you know, largely, and obviously, like an iMac for the money is more powerful than a MacBook Air. It has better specs. But does it matter for your day-to-day use? Can you tell the difference between a MacBook Air and an iMac? And I bet for a lot of people, they can't. And so as tablets continue to get more powerful, you know, where is that? Are we 2 years away from the average person being able to encode video on iMovie on their iPad and it feel roughly the same as their MacBook Air? I don't know. And that'll be interesting, is when kind of like your average use case, the power needs are the same.
Yeah, for sure. I want to throw out two more things from this UK survey, and I'm sure there will be similar surveys in the US as well. One of the interesting questions they asked was they asked about parents who had tablets and their kids used their tablet. What were their opinions of the tablet's usefulness in terms of an educational tool? And that was a very interesting question to ask for that kind of survey. And what they found was that they asked people to agree or be neutral or disagree with this statement that my tablet is useful for educating the children and helping with homework. And the numbers they got back from that were that 60% of parents agreed that this was true. And then 25% neither particularly agreed nor disagreed, which leaves you with a stat that says 85% of parents who own tablets are at least neutral to positive about the tablet's impact on their child's education. Only 9% actively disagreed and the rest were don't know on that one. So I thought that was very interesting because that ties in very closely with what I've seen at schools that I've dealt with where they've gone and they've asked parents in the school, do you think we should do something like this? And I've seen numbers of 85 to 90%, you know, immediate agreement with this. And this, again, goes back to my contention about the sort of demographics of parents. And we talked about this on the show before, Bradley, that parents are sort of waiting for schools to do something here. They're no longer sort of being surprised by the notion that you might use tablets in schools. That's become a thing that people do now. And in some places, it's become a thing that people expect you to do as well. And certainly from the Ofcom numbers, it's something that parents are overwhelmingly already at least in favour of or keen to find out about or at least neutral about. And it's very unlikely that you're going to get a large proportion of disagreement. Now, the local situation might be different for your school, but that's the numbers that are being shown in the UK.
Yeah, those numbers are very, very interesting. And I think as a parent of a kid that's going to be entering school in really a few months, my son will start at our pre-K program in the fall. Do I expect more or less technology in the workplace in the next 10 years? There'll be more. Do I expect more or less technology in the home in the next 10 years? There'll be more. So why would the school be any different?
Exactly. Well, the school will be different because it'll take a while for it to catch up. But that's the only reason. It shouldn't be different, I don't think.
No.
So that's the kind of national context. I'm using UK examples. I know there's at least one survey that you could look at in the US, which is called the New Media Consortium do this thing called the Horizons Report for K-12, where they look at what things are sort of coming in the next. They break it down into time horizons. So they have like 1 to 2 years. These two or three things will be likely in schools, 3 to 4 years, 5 to 6 years and beyond. You know, and it's things like 3D printing and biometrics and you know, heads-up displays and different things. And they sort of try and place these out in different timelines. It's not quite the same thing as the Ofcom report because it's not a survey. It's more of an expert panel-based report. But it's still a useful future-looking thing to be aware of too. Okay, so I guess bringing it down to the local situation, I think people should be thinking a little bit more about, well, what does that mean for here? What does that mean for this school? Because although we can say that in general, you know, AB households in the UK have 92% internet access, is that true for your school? You want to make sure that it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where good discussion with your parents up front is helpful. And even if you're just doing kind of demographic surveys, those are just helpful to understand, again, where you're at.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in some ways, the key message that I want people to take away from this is go and ask, right? I've dealt with so many schools where I've gone in and the first thing they say to me is, well, you know, the management want us to do iPads, but that'll never work for our kids because, and then they say, because they're poor, because they don't have internet access, because they'll be mugged on the way home for the devices. And they give reasons after reason, and different reasons, different schools, but they give reasons why it won't work here. And then I say, well, have you asked people about that? Have you done a survey? What kind of numbers do you see? And they say, well, we haven't done a survey, but we just know that it's not going to work here. And quite often I sort of take a breath and say, well, you know, let's talk about how we could organise a survey so that we could go out to parents and ask, you know, can you make a contribution to the cost of this programme, for example? And that's a key question, right? You know, if you're going to make the deployment, you're going to make it sustainable. How are you going to make it sustainable? Can you afford it out your budget? Probably not. Maybe, but probably not. And then the question is, well, can parents contribute? In your current context, are you even allowed to ask parents to contribute? That's something that might not be true for some schools. I've certainly been to schools where it has been, if not the actual the letter of the law, is at least the sort of tradition of the area that your parents don't get asked to pay for anything for school. You're not allowed to go and ask the parents for stuff.
I know our local public system is that way. I mean, not even just technology, but if a kid doesn't pay for a field trip, they still get to go. I mean, they literally cannot ask them for $5. You know, they can say that's a $5, you know, they can say it's a, there's a $5 supply fee, but they can't force you to pay.
Yeah.
And the, you know, then you know, looking at, you know, our private schools, you know, how is there an opportunity for you to use that as a way to drive admissions? And if you don't, the other school, the schools you compete with probably are, because mm-hmm. they've been thinking about this for 2 years. Like if you're thinking we can't do this, well, the other schools that you compete with are.
Yep.
And as a parent of a young kid, if I, you know, obviously I work at a school, but if I went into a school and they're sitting around with Windows XP on HPs that are covered in dust, and they talk about their great technology, kind of concerned there.
For sure. I mean, people ask me all the time, you know, have you seen a huge change in admissions since you went iPad? And to be truthful, the answer is not really. Although what it has done, I think, is it's when people have come to us for other reasons and they've seen our program, they have been impressed by that, and that maybe has made them more keen to send their children to the school. But I don't think anybody has particularly come to the school and said, we've heard you're the iPad school in the area, we want to send our kids here because iPad. Right? It's usually they want to send their kids for some other reason, and the iPads are just, you know, something that they think is to the good, shall we say.
Taking that a step further, not in your context, but let's say you're a school that did do iPads and your admissions stayed the same. Would it have gotten worse without your technology upgrades? Because if you're not
also possible,
yeah. Because if you're not moving forward, you're often moving backwards.
And it's an interesting thing that we've started to see with, you know, children that have left our school to go to other schools for various, you know, moving away or whatever. I know in a lot of cases, those parents have, you know, the day after they've left our school, gone and bought their kids an iPad so they could continue what they were doing from us, at least at home, if not actually in the school they're going to as well. So that's something that's of interest too, is like how do you sort of facilitate that transition both in and out of an iPad school as well, which is kind of another topic for another show probably, just to talk about that. But it's quite interesting to think about what that could mean as well. So we've talked about parent support, and it's crucial to ask these questions, but I want to also caution against being bound by the results of asking that question, because I think I've certainly seen some situations where people have said, well, we've got to get 100% support or we can't do it. And of course, you never get 100% of anything, but you know, just because one family doesn't want to do it, does that mean that the whole school is going to be held hostage by that? Shouldn't really be that way. But if you've only got 15% support, then you've got more work to do than that. So you've got to be sensible about it. But I would caution against looking for 100% mandate before you move forward with these things.
And if you've got a 15% support level, you might also question what you're communicating. Have you done a good Absolutely. Job of communicating what this can do in the classroom and how you're going to use it?
Yes, and that goes back to the last show, Bradley, vision and leadership. That if you're unable to sell your vision to more than 15%, let's say, of the parent body, then there's probably something wrong with your vision. That's a solid pushback that you should maybe go back to the drawing board and think again about what it is you're planning to do. I can't say what that might be. I mean, this is a hypothetical situation, but, you know, have you communicated properly the educational benefits? Have you made it seem like a structured and well-organized plan rather than something you're doing because the school down the road is doing it? Have you made it seem or made it clear to people how you're going to do it? Do you appear to have the capability to do it? And so on and so on and so on. So those are all key questions too. So I guess the other thing you want to consider, we've talked about parents, we've talked about, you know, the regulatory environment and the macroeconomic and the future environment, but what about your staff? Right? Do you have the staff to do this? And that, by that I mean both the teaching staff, but also the IT staff. And this is one thing, and this is sort of the dirty secret of a lot of iPad deployments that go wrong, is that it's not actually the teacher's fault. It's the IT department's fault, that they've just been obstructive and they've made it break. I'm not saying in every situation that's true, but it's certainly I'm sure you've had phone calls, Bradley, as I've had phone calls about people phone me up and they ask me what to tell their IT department who are being obstructive. Do you ever get that kind of call?
The call I mainly get are from the schools that don't have one and think that the iPad is, you know, a simple device since they don't need any kind of really strong infrastructure or support. And then, you know, rather than hiring someone to manage the program first, they just go out and buy a bunch of devices, usually from a grant or something. And so that's the call I get. And again, talk about not having the right staff. You don't have any staff.
Yeah, exactly. So do you have the staff capability to do this kind of deployment? Partly, you can always have a false sense of security about that because you think you do, but you actually don't, is potentially an issue. The call I get a lot is, you know, we want to use iPads, but we're being told by IT that we can't do them because X, Y, or Z, some kind of vaguely technical sounding reason that actually isn't a problem, but it sounds like it is a problem. Can you give us any advice on what to say to them? I get this call so often. And I can usually say, well, here's how we did it. We did it with this or that or the next thing, or we took that bit away or we put this other bit in or whatever. And then teachers can go back and or head teachers usually can go back and say that to their IT people. Well, that's something to be aware of.
Well, and that also goes – go ahead.
I was just going to say it's something to be aware of both ways. What do your staff think about this program? And don't just focus on the teaching staff because that's, you know, the teachers in charge of the school often think, well, how are the teachers going to react? You've also got to think about those ancillary staff as well.
Yeah, and that again goes back to the last episode that, you know, if this is driven by the teachers and the administration is so-so about it, but said, okay, you know, we'll do it. But if they're not forcing the IT staff to get on board, then you're going to have a roadblock there. But if it starts at the vision comes from the top, the IT people don't have to be convinced. They're told to make it work. Just how, you know, the iPhone got into the enterprise from the CEO telling the IT staff to make it get my email. You know, yes. I don't care that it's less secure. I want my email on it. You know, I don't care that it doesn't work with your BlackBerry server. Get my email on it. And so, you know, I was hired in preparation of a technology initiative. You know, that was our strategic plan called for technology growth, but the first thing was hire someone, which it seems so simple, but it's so key that piece is first. Because then I came on and I had to own everything we did. It wasn't that I came on and inherited, you know, things that were bought from a grant. I came on and, you know, we made it work and I had to make it work because they were my decisions. But again, it goes back from vision at the top.
Absolutely. And if you can't make your IT staff do it, then it's time to find some new IT staff. But there's also the issue that in some schools, the IT staff don't even work for you. You know, like the head teacher has no authority over the IT department. Right? That's another situation you have to be aware of. And that has, you end up doing a lot of kind of wheeling and dealing in that situation because the IT staff maybe work for the local authority or the council or the state or whoever, and the head teacher is forced to use them as a service but has no authority to make them do anything, right? So the head teacher can't phone up and say, get these ports open on my Wi-Fi, and the IT people can just say, well, that's not part of our port mapping policy, so you can just beat it, you know? Those are, you know, not uncommon situations as well. So that's something you've got to be aware of, is do you even have the authority over these people to get the program up and running the way you want it? And lastly, let's talk about staff as well. I mean, because staff are key, right? And if you don't get the teachers on board, what are you going to do? You're going to struggle a little bit. But I think the key thing, the way I want to suggest that people think about this is don't try and convince all your staff. Recognize that there's going to be 10% at the top who will just follow you wherever, and there's going to be 10% at the bottom who probably won't follow you no matter what you do. But there's a big chunk of people in the middle waiting to be convinced either way. And the trick is in convincing the critical mass of those people onto your vision. And again, Bradley, back to your leadership and vision and plan of last week, sell these people on the vision. Get them on board, but also, you know, we mentioned consulting a wee bit last week. Consult them for their views, hear what they've got to say, and also, you know, more at my level of the school, secondary education, hear what specific subject teachers have to say about it. Because I know you've been talking to some schools where the maths teachers, for example, really want a high-quality stylus input, for example. And that's something that's been a blocker in schools I've been to as well, is that the maths teachers want something special. But you've got to hear a lot of these voices to be sure that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah, it's you're better to ask than to just assume.
Always. And I think that's probably the message of this whole show, is that there's data out there that you can use to get a picture of the broad context, the macroeconomics, the future, the national context. But then you've got to actually take that expectation and validate it against what's actually happening in your school and show that either we... If you want to claim that your school is some kind of exceptional little snowflake in the whole situation, you've got to have some data to prove that, right? If you want to say, well, you know, we buck the national trend because of blah, 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 well, then show me the survey where you showed that that was true, right? Certainly if your school's very big, right? If your school's 2,000 people, you know, that's there's a good chance that that's probably going to reflect the national averages pretty closely. If your school's 100 kids, like my school is, we have very, very spiky profiles with a lot of that stuff, whereas bigger schools, you're obviously going to hit closer to national averages and a lot of that stuff. Let me give you my key points to finish. Is there anything you want to throw in, Bradley?
Well, I think one of the things that concerns me with a lot of deployments is not the deployment this year, but the deployment 3 or 4 years from now. And understanding, you know, especially schools that get a big grant, you need to be working in money into your budget to overhaul everything you're doing in years to come, because you can't be guaranteed that you're going to get that grant again. It's almost better if you don't get a grant and you have to make it work either by asking for donations from your parents, asking them to support the program either with a technology fee or something, or work it into your budget. And that's why I've been a big fan of leasing, because it's easier for us to work in, you know, yearly or monthly payments for something than having to come up with $100,000 every third or fourth year. But you need to be planning for having to replace not only the device. I mean, that's obviously, you know, if we say that an iPad is, you know, we'll keep it for 3 years. Okay, so we got that. But also your Wi-Fi, also your switches, also cabling, also firewall, also any sort of servers you have. You need to be planning to replace that stuff, because if you don't, then you're going to wait 7 years and all of it's going to be dead. It's going to be terrible.
Yeah.
You know, it's like it's like when you look at schools that still have hubs in their switch closets now. I mean, that's what, you know, obviously, you know, that'll, you know, I guess 10 years from now, we'll say, well, they've still got just, you know, gigabit switches in their closet, you know, when we have 100 gig ports or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's what you'll end up doing. So from a financial perspective, start preparing now for the future.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that, because I think that teachers are used to getting a very large payoff for any amount of effort they put in. So if you spend time, for example, to develop a program around, I don't know, like spelling for five-year-olds, let's say, it makes sense that you could roll out that program next year and the year after for, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years or however long. Technology has the unfortunate attribute of changing too often to get that kind of payoff. So you have to be careful about how much kind of goodwill you burn on that. And you can sometimes end up in a situation where you just finished one transition, you want to do another one, right? So if teachers don't feel like they're going to get a solid payoff for investing in one of these kind of programs, it's going to be a hard sell, right? So what I mean by this is that teachers have to believe that this is here forever. And again, we made this point on the last show, Bradley, and we'll make it on this show, and I'm sure we'll make it in future shows. But it's all about giving people a strong belief that this is a thing that's happening and it's not going to change. It's not going to go away. And it's something that you have to invest in now so that you will get that benefit in years to come.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if, as we said, if teachers think there's a way out in 3 years, they're just going to keep doing what they're doing.
Yep. So let's go back over what we've said here. This has been a kind of, in some ways, this show, I feel, is a little bit like a comma in the conversation, where I'm asking you to sort of pause a little bit and think about, where is it that you're going? Where are we? Where is the world? How do all these things that are moving very fast, how do they move together? And I think the key tasks that come out of this week's show, I think, are to, number one, become informed about where the world is going. Okay? Don't be one of these people who are surprised every time something happens. You know, like a new iOS app comes out, that, you know, Snapchat appears out of nowhere. Are you surprised by that? Well, should you be, really? Because messaging is big, taking pictures is big. We saw Instagram coming. Well, you know, that's kind of putting two and two together. You get Snapchat, for example. There's lots of data you can use, is point number two. There's survey data, there's market research, there's job market analysis, tech sector analysis, economic analysis. There's analysis coming out for years. And the trick is to kind of find the signal in all of that and find analysts and find channels of data that are reliable and appropriate for what it is you want to do. It's not like we're just guessing here. It's really important, though, you don't just listen to one or two voices. You've got to listen to a broad range of bits of input. So if you only read Ofcom, or if you only read the New Media Consortium, if you only listen to this podcast, you know, go and find some other podcasts that say something different. And then the key thing, again, leadership, be critical and decide for yourself what it is you're going to do based on everything that you know. Not just on what you heard last time at the last thing you went to, but based on your awareness of the whole situation, as much as any one person can, knowing what's happening with jobs, knowing what's happening in the economy, knowing what's happening with technology, where do you want to go? Pick up on all of that. Also be aware of how national or international data applies to your school or to your area. And at the end of the day, Bradley, your point, I think, is the one that I want to leave people with, is that you've got to go and ask people. You've got to go and talk to people, find out what they're thinking, find out where they are, and get the data that tells you that, you know, 9 out of 10 parents are perfectly happy to pay for an iPad program in the school. What do we do about that 10% that don't? Can we persuade them some other way, or can we find some other budget to cover what they can't pay? And is the reason that they don't want to pay for an iPad, is it a principle objection, or is it a cost objection, or is it some other kind of thing? You know, you've got to go and find out that information before you really know what you're facing, before you can then start to put in place all the things that we'll talk about later about Wi-Fi and leasing and devices and all that kind of stuff. Know what you're facing first, and then make a plan for how you're going to deal with it all.
It's a lot to think about. And I mean, and it's a lot of 50,000 foot thoughts for something that is quote unquote as simple as an iPad program.
Yeah.
But I think the key is, you need to think about all these things so you can make the right decisions on the front end, and you're not in year one and thinking, I just wish we had done that, or we wish we had thought about that.
Yeah. I mean, I fear that, you know, if you've worked in a school where all you've ever known is Microsoft products, and you're close with Microsoft, and you've used Microsoft, and everybody's trained in Microsoft, then your next step may be to go out and buy Surface tablets. I think that, you know, some things are changing fairly rapidly, and Microsoft's position of dominance in the industry is one thing that is changing very rapidly. And I think that that's just one example of, if you're not aware of the bigger trends, if you're not aware of the sort of predicament that Microsoft is in, if you're not aware of how the world has responded to, say, Windows 8, for example, you could easily make the wrong decision, because the past is not always an indicator of future performance in technology as it isn't in stocks either. So those are the kind of things that I want to encourage people to think about this week. And then as we go on, we'll start to see how some of those decisions can start to impact specific things that you have to decide about once it comes to things like acceptable use policy, like it comes to people's safety approaches. How can you deal with damage? How can you deal with loss? All of those things. A lot of the decisions that you will make in those shows come out of things you've learned and thought about on the basis of this show. So don't skip over this one, I think, is my message. This is important too.
Yes, very much so.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there for this week, Bradley. Is that okay with you?
That sounds good.
Okay. So we'll pick up again next week. What's our next in our list? I'm not sure.
It is
infrastructure.
infrastructure analysis. So we start next week kind of putting some, I guess, cables in the building and plugging up switches and picking out some Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be a really important show because I've certainly heard of some schools recently where they've got a whole bunch of iPads but no Wi-Fi. That certainly feels a wee bit like the cart before the horse.
Yeah, it's email is so great on my iPad when the internet doesn't work or there is no internet. It's like,
yeah, email's the only thing that's improved when the internet doesn't work is your email client.
And don't forget about the Notepad app. Like, you, I can make some great notes on the tablet with no internet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that next week. I'm looking forward to that show. I think there's a lot of useful things to talk about in there, both networking and other bits of hardware and so on. With what you've got and what you're going to have to get. So we'll talk to you all next week. Bradley, where can people find us this week?
I'm on the web at Chambers Daily and on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. You can leave a review for the show on iTunes. We'd love that if you did. And always our feedback form is open at outofschool.net. So thanks for listening and we'll talk to you next week.
Have a good week, everybody.